Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Benjamin T. Smith, author of the book, The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade. Ben, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Mark.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor of Latin American history. I currently work at the University of Warwick in the UK. From 2005 to 2013, I was working at Michigan State University. I've always specialized on the history of Mexico, mostly the 19th and 20th centuries history of Mexico. I've written about the press, about indigenous movements, about Catholicism, religion, conservatism. And I've now turned my hand to writing about something you really can't miss about Mexico, which is the narcotics trade.
What led you to shift your attention to a topic that has such an interesting perspective on the history of Mexico and the history of Mexico's relationships with the United States?
Well, in some ways, what I'm doing here is building on stuff that I've already worked on. So particularly the kind of local politics, local peasant networks, local commercial networks. So I've studied these kind of things before, but not really related to narcotics, mostly related to things like coffee or other kind of agricultural products. So in some ways, it was within my wheelhouse. Why did I turn to it? Frankly, because it was impossible to ignore. And I was in Mexico about 6 months of every year while I was at Michigan State University, either doing research or hanging out with family or seeing friends. And this was the period when Felipe Calderón came to power in Mexico and launched a particularly aggressive war on drugs. And this had catastrophic effects across the country. And as a result, I thought it was important in order to understand what was going on in the present, to understand the past. And when I returned to the UK, I was very lucky to get a grant from the British government in order to do this.
It really is a fascinating book because I was impressed with how many different levels at which you're addressing this. You're talking about you know this topic that there has been quite a bit written on, but you're talking about it from different angles. You're talking simultaneously. You're talking about the history of U.S.-Mexico relations. You're talking about America's own engagement with narcotics and efforts to address it. And you're also talking about the effects of this trade upon the people of Mexico, the local economy. And I thought what was most fascinating was how the various governments within Mexico at the local, state, and even federal level have oftentimes not so much combated the trade as harnessed it for their own ends. And that was a dynamic that is something that you don't often see discussed too much in terms of the popular understanding of Mexico and the drug trade.
No, you're completely true. I mean, so effectively what happens and what has happened for the last 100 years is local, mostly local mayors and state governors have effectively run what I term protection rackets. So they approach a trafficker and they say, we can put you in prison or you can pay me a certain percentage of your profits and I will protect you from prosecution either by the Americans or by the federal government of Mexico. Now, this is often termed corruption, and in many cases it is. And the state governors and many mayors have got very rich out of this practice. But I think what I found somewhat surprising was many of these governors and mayors actually tried to funnel some of this money towards building up the state. Now, in the 30s and 40s, this was building schools, it was building roads, it was making sure they had enough kind of teachers to fill these schools. But by the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, it was about building the police force itself. So these protection rackets were actually, as I say, it's easy to just dismiss them as private corruption. But in actual fact, they had a fairly major state building purpose to them, which I hope I bring out in the book.
It's a dynamic that it's an aspect of it that I find especially relevant, given, you know, an American myself growing up in the United States, how we've gone from the, you know, war on drugs, how, you know, just say no and zero tolerance, to the point where in the United States now you're seeing the acceptance at least of marijuana, and now it's being promoted as, well, this is something we can tax and the state can benefit from this. It seems as though that you're starting to see this perspective beginning to take hold, at least with regards to marijuana, as you demonstrate, that many officials in Mexico have had virtually since the beginning.
Well, I think they have, and I think it's impossible to get. It's important to understand that the reason they were doing this was effectively there was virtually zero drug taking in Mexico. There was a minor kind of bubble of marijuana taking in the kind of 1910s, 1920s, around the era of the revolution, where lots of soldiers would use it as a kind of as a salve, as a balm. But beyond that, Mexico, until the last 15 years or so, has never had a drug problem. So they effectively were taxing something, a commercial product that wasn't harming Mexico. And that's certainly the way that they saw it. In fact, and though this is very difficult to actually prove, one sotto voce, off the record, people will tell you that one of the parts of this agreement was that the traffickers did not sell in Mexico itself. So during the 1970s, for example, Mexico was the United States' major heroin producer. It provided somewhere in the region of 95%. Of America's heroin, rather like it does today. And yet they tried to do a survey of drug taking in Mexico, and they literally, I think they surveyed about 16,000 people, and they couldn't find a heroin addict. So it appears 0% on the study. So this is, you know, partially why they did this.
I thought that was something that was very interesting when you're in talking your early chapters about Mexico in the early 20th century. It was a very different Mexico than it is today. We're talking about a country that's goes from military dictatorship to convulsed by revolution, and how, you know, Mexico, the gulf between Mexico and the United States is enormous during this time, and how it really underscores the degree to which this trade that you describe emerging really is a trade in the United States and not a trade designed to feed indigenous Mexicans. What was it that sparked it in the early 20th century? And how does that, the fact that they're targeting this market to the north, shape the development of the drug trade?
That's a really good question. So essentially, it appears as soon as America make narcotics illegal with the 1914 Harrison Act. So after that, many traffickers start bringing in particularly morphine, heroin to a certain extent, and a very small extent cocaine. They normally take it in. The vast majority of these narcotics are still made in drug factories. in Europe. So they import them in, along the east coast of Mexico, and then transport them normally by train up to the border, either to the crossing at Mexicali or Tijuana or Ciudad Juarez. And from these places, they then go on to the rest of the United States. So I think initially it's also fairly important to kind of bear out that Mexico, really up to the 1960s, only really produced somewhere in the region of 20, 30, 40% of the hard narcotics that the US used. There was a brief burst of activity in the late 1940s as well, but really it was probably only the kind of second biggest producer of narcotics for the US market. The vast majority of this was still made in Europe and came into the east coast of the United States. So I think that's important to kind of to point out as well. Things completely change in the 1960s.
Who's involved in the drug trade in Mexico in first half of the 20th century? Are we talking about, does this involve professionals? Does this involve local farmers who are hooking up with Americans? Or is this something where you're seeing indigenous networks developing that are getting involved?
So initially, so during the period, say, 1910 to into the 1930s, the vast majority of people who do this are either basically small-scale businessmen or small-scale smugglers who are smuggling alcohol across to the United States anyway, and they decide to smuggle drugs as well. Many of the people who import these actual narcotics are pharmacists because they have the contacts in Europe. They know who to tap up for bits of morphine and bits of heroin. So it's a fairly kind of professional network initially. However, during the 1940s, because of the Second World War, Mexico and the United States get cut off from the main suppliers of heroin and morphine in the world. So as a result, Mexico starts to produce homemade, homegrown morphine and heroin. And what that involves is hundreds of villages in the western mountains of Mexico starting to grow poppies and being taught by people how to extract the gum from these poppies. And then from about 1943, 1944 onwards, getting the chemical knowledge to make morphine and heroin out of these raw materials. So it's really the kind of mid-1940s and World War II that allows Mexico to become to create its own kind of, as you rightly say, kind of indigenous networks of drug producers, drug smugglers, and drug sellers. And I think what's kind of remarkable is that still today, I mean, we hear these kind of many stories of large, I don't really like the term, but kingpins like Chapo Guzman or Caro Quintero or Ernesto Fonseca, and they come from exactly the same villages, and they are the grandsons and great-grandsons of people who were doing this in the 1940s. And when you read the documents from the 1940s, it's kind of extraordinary. Exactly the same surnames pop up. So this has a fairly long heritage.
What's interesting, another interesting aspect about it is people nowadays, when they think of the Mexican drug trade and like, you know, Calderon's war on drugs and the images of you know, shootouts and brutalities and assassinations, is how that wasn't there for so much of the history of the drug trade. I hate to use this word because it seems like it's trivializing, but it's almost quaint reading your early chapters where you're describing this much more localized, much more peaceful, definitely not the right word for it, but a much less aggressive, drug trade in terms of demarcating territory, handling shipments and so forth. You certainly describe plenty of violence, but it's on nowhere near the scale that people might associate with it today.
Yeah, well, I think that was the kind of point that I really wanted to bring out, is that the drug trade doesn't have to be violent per se, right? So there was a time, I think, during the late 1990s, early 2000s, when British Columbia in Canada was producing the vast majority of the West Coast of the United States marijuana, and yet homicide rates never went up there, right? So there is no intrinsic reason why this commercial activity has to be violent. It is simply the act of growing something, processing that thing, and then transporting that thing from one point to another. There is no violence inherent in that. Where the violence does come in, and this is my argument throughout the book, is the protection racket, because in order to make a drug trafficker pay, you've got to threaten him. Or you've got to, it's not simply a pleasant kind of, it is extortion. You're effectively extorting this drug trafficker. So that obviously is a relatively violent act. The other way, the other thing that brings violence is basically the ferocity of the war on drugs. And up to the 1960s, in general, there wasn't a terribly aggressive war on drugs. And if you got caught, even with mountains of coke or heroin, you were unlikely to go to jail for more than a year or so. So there was very little incentive to kind of fight back.
What influences a lot of this, as you make clear in your book, is the relationship with the United States. How does the United States, up to the early 1960s, influence Mexico's response to it? Because it really is a very conflict response, because those protection rackets you described, we're not talking about criminals who are entirely the private sector. We're oftentimes talking about, as you've already mentioned, local officials, state officials, sometimes even federal police who are providing this. So you have on the one hand this sort of involvement, but you also have on the other hand that it is ultimately the government that, when we do see arrests and crackdowns, it's being done by the government. It's almost a schizophrenic response that you know plays to the divided mind of Mexican officials.
Yeah, I mean this is something that I did find fascinating. So is that officials on one hand are building institutions using the money from drug trafficking, but at the same time, they are occasionally doing the bidding of the United States and cracking down on that very same drug trade. And this is, in a way, this is how the protection racket works, because the Mexican authorities continually have this stick to hold over the traffickers. They continually say, if you don't keep paying us, we'll give you up to the Americans, or we'll do what they actually want us to do. So this allows them to charge fairly large amounts of money from these traffickers. In terms of what the US's relationship to this early drug trade, well, the kind of the czar, the drug czar in the United States was a man called Harry Anslinger, who ran the Bureau of Narcotics. And I think what I found is he appears in particularly in 1940, he stops Mexico effectively decriminalizing drugs. Now, Mexico does at that point have a fairly a group of very radical doctors in the kind of highest echelons of the government, and they believe that it is better for Mexico not to produce illegal narcotics, but rather for the government to buy narcotics and sell these at a very low price to addicts. As a result, their idea is they're going to put the actual drug traffickers and the drug vendors out of business. And Harry Anslinger takes a very, very dim view of this and basically bullies Mexico and cajoles it and threatens it and basically extorts Mexico to stop this particular project. However, after that, I think Anslinger is concerned effectively with his position in the United States. And once he's shown that he can bully a country like Mexico, he effectively allows it to run its own drug policy, certainly from the kind of late 1940s onwards. And it's a relatively kind of hands-off operation. All these things obviously change really with the election of Nixon, and much more pressure is put on Mexico to clear up its drug trafficking networks and its drug production. But up to the 1970s, it's a relatively kind of hands-off approach that the U.S. uses.
Now, we're getting to this period that you've already alluded to a couple of times where things really start to change, and that's the 1960s. And Nixon is, in many ways, a reaction to it rather than a source of it. I was wondering if you could explain what's happening in the 1960s to bring about change in the Mexican drug trade and what are the changes that these forces are bringing about?
Yes, certainly. So the most obvious change is, frankly, the counterculture. So up to the 1960s, very, very few white middle-class Americans took narcotics, at least since the late 19th century. However, during the 1960s, there's an enormous kind of youth explosion, and many of these people start to smoke marijuana. I mean, extraordinary numbers that I think they even shock me. Things like 40% of high schoolers during this period have tried marijuana, whereas in Mexico, I think it's about 1% of high schoolers have tried marijuana. So this creates an enormous market, and many of these hippies, for use of a better word, they go down to Mexico and start to buy up marijuana in bulk. And this basically like adding kind of jet fuel to the Mexican drug industry. And it goes from a fairly small industry that is located really in the mountains of western Mexico to one that covers the vast majority of rural Mexico. So it really grows in size. It expands enormously during that period. Now, then in 1972, the United States and France and Turkey cracked down on something that has become known as the French Connection, which was basically the traditional network of heroin producers in Europe, which produced heroin for the US market. Something around 70 to 80% of America's heroin came from this particular connection. When this breaks down, Mexico almost immediately fills the breach. Mexico starts to produce the vast amount of the vast majority of Mexican heroin during this era. So up to about, I think about 1976, it's 95% of the US's heroin comes from Mexico. So those two changes, one, the market for marijuana, followed by bang, the market for heroin, completely changed the scale of the Mexican drug trade.
And how does this lead to the increase in violence? Is it a matter of market competition, or is it a consequence of the war on drugs effectively escalating the stakes for the dealers?
That's a really good question. So I think initially, like many people who were studying the drug trade, I assumed it was market competition, right? I assumed that effectively there was, say, one drug trafficker in a town, another drug trafficker came along, and they competed over who would smuggle narcotics through a particular smuggling route. But in actual fact, what I found is the vast majority of traffickers cooperated. Why? Because the market in America is so vast, there is no need to compete. So you basically cooperate in order to make the huge amounts of money that you can on the US market. So I found very little actual market competition between drug traffickers. I think this is a real mistake in a lot of the literature, is to assume that these groups are highly aggressive capitalists that cannot couch any kind of competition. Most of the time, they're cooperating. However, what happens in the 1970s is the war on drugs is launched with a kind of a degree of ferocity that was pretty shocking to me. So what happens is the American agents, first from something called the BNDD, Bureau of Narcotic and Dangerous Drugs, and then from the DEA, turn up in Mexico. They ally with a group of Mexican policemen, mostly from something called the Federal Police Force, the PJF. And they start really kind of hammering drug traffickers. So they will arrest people. They will torture them brutally for information. They will then often turn them into informants. And what I found is that by doing so, they broke down these networks of cooperation, because when one trafficker was in a town and another trafficker turns up, immediately assumed that this guy might be an informant for the PJF. So this causes a lot of the kind of intra-trafficker violence. So you've got kind of two types of violence happening. One, you have the state and its DEA, American agent allies, torturing and killing drug traffickers. And two, you have these drug traffickers becoming increasingly paranoid about the use of informants and the fact that if they're given up, they're not going to get 1 year in jail anymore. They're probably going to be tortured. The police might well pick up their family and torture them. And after all that, they might well get 20 to 30 years in jail. So the stakes rise massively. And I think this also kind of causes the violence.
And yet,
sorry.
And yet at the same time, you're this is doing absolutely nothing to diminish the drug trade, because as you've explained, the market in the United States is so great that you remove any one individual and that vacuum is going to be filled almost instantaneously.
Right. I mean, you're absolutely correct. I suppose, and what the DEA certainly argued, was this incredibly violent crackdown, particularly in rural areas during the from 1976 through to about 1979, which had the name, well, the Mexicans called it Operation Condor. The Americans called it, off camera, the Atrocities. It was effectively the army and the PGF marching into rural Mexico and kidnapping, arresting, torturing brutally, often killing peasant drug producers. Now, I suppose what this does have is it shifts slightly the focus of the Mexican drug trade. No doubt, by the late 70s, they still are producing marijuana and also producing opium in order to make into heroin. However, they also move much more heavily at this point into cocaine. And this is when links are made with Colombian and Peruvian cocaine producers, and Mexico starts becoming this key transshipment point for cocaine from South America. So you're right. The US market at that time for cocaine is growing massively, late 70s, early 80s. And as a result, Mexico yet again steps into the breach and becomes America's kind of emergency drug shipper.
And as you describe, this starts to have very detrimental effects on the Mexican state itself. That you have a state that is never, has not, you know, necessarily been healthy during this period, but they nonetheless have enjoyed a degree of authority that has been acknowledged and has been effective. But the sheer amount of money that you note that you identify going into this trade now because of the cocaine being added to heroin and marijuana, now they're starting to, it's creating a destabilization effect that is really undermining the ability of the Mexican state to do its non-drug enforcement functions.
Right, absolutely. So up to really the late 1980s, the state had control of these protection rackets, i.e. it approached the traffickers and it bullied, cajoled, tortured and threatened them and got money out of them. It was in control. However, really two things happen in the late 80s, early 90s, which change all this. And one, as you point out, is just the level of money. So particularly after the Americans go after Colombian kingpins like the Cali cartel, like Pablo Escobar, the Colombians rewrite their deal with the Mexicans. Previously, the Mexicans had just earned a fee for taking cocaine over the border, about $1,000 per kilo, right? A kilo is worth at that point about $20,000. However, during the early 90s, they rewrite this contract and they effectively say, if you take over 1 kilo of cocaine, we will give you another kilo of cocaine. So now for moving 2 kilos of cocaine, you're not getting $2,000, you're getting $20,000. So it basically sticks a zero on the earnings of the Mexican cartels and makes them, in some cases and in some places, more powerful than the state. And they start to take over the protection rackets. Now, the other reason that they can do this is that the Mexican state at the time is going through a process of democratization. So the one party, the single party that had run elections and run the state from 1929 to 2000, starts to lose elections to other parties. So it no longer has control over these protection rackets. And in their place come these, for use of a better term, cartels, which start to take them over. And are much less easy to control.
So how does this basically set the stage for the Mexican drug trade that we see in the media today? And to what degree does the media today and the government pronouncements really fail to capture what's going on in the modern day drug trade?
Well, I think what they fail to capture is we assume that there is still this kind of moral binary. On the one hand, you have good cops, and on the other hand, you have evil traffickers. And the violence is either traffickers killing other traffickers, or it's the state attempting to kind of crack down on these traffickers. But in actual fact, what's going on is a bit more complicated than that. Everyone is struggling at the moment in Mexico to gain monopolistic control, not over the trade, but over protection of the trade, i.e. they're trying to gain control of a certain amount of territory and shake down or extort all the people who produce or traffic drugs in this area, right? And that is what the struggle is over. However, another thing that's added to this is the struggle isn't simply over protection of the drug trade anymore. It's over protection of a whole gamut of illegal activities, car theft, robbery, kidnapping, extortion. So these kind of cartels and their allies within the state are all struggling to gain a monopoly over these particular protection rackets in different regions. And that's what you see on the news. It's not a fight of one drug cartel against another, or a drug cartel against the state. It's a fight of an alliance of cartels and bits of the state against other cartels and bits of the state. And that's what's going on. And I apologize for being a little kind of complicated and dogmatic in that particular section.
Well, it is a very complicated dynamic that you're describing.
Yeah, I mean, it is. There are other things, I think, big kind of structural changes which have also affected it. I mean, one is the legalization, as you mentioned, or decriminalization of marijuana, which means that a lot of Mexican traffickers have gotten out of the marijuana business. What have they gone to? Well, they've gone into initially they went into the amphetamine business in the early 2000s. Then they went back to heroin during the kind of late 2000s. And by now they've moved into this horrific kind of fentanyl market, which is a product which is about 50 times stronger than morphine and is killing somewhere around 100,000 US addicts per year, which is an extraordinary and very distressing number. Another major dynamic, which I don't think we take, or certainly a lot of Americans perhaps fail to acknowledge, is that the US gun market has effectively flooded Mexico with high caliber automatic guns. So since basically the law was changed in 2004, and it became much easier to buy automatic weapons in the United States, hundreds of smugglers have started smuggling these guns into Mexico. And it's fascinating. I was talking to another researcher in Mexico who was explaining that he was doing interviews with certain basically cartel hitmen. And they were saying in the early 2000s, no one had a gun. The boss had a gun. Maybe you got a kind of knackered Central American M16 if you were lucky. But you did most of your kind of punishment beatings with a stick, right? However, everything changed. They said 2004, 2005, suddenly everyone got a gun. And Mexico has gone from a place where I think about 20 to 30% of murders were committed by a gun to a place in which 70 to 80% of murders are committed by a firearm. So I think just the ease of killing people with firearms has made killing or has made the kind of the homicide rate rise very rapidly.
Now, what we've been talking about has been the history of the drug trade, as you describe it in your book. And yet I feel that to describe it as we have, it gives a misleading impression of it, because one of the things you never lose sight of in your book is the human element. You open your book with the account of a particular individual in present day Mexico, and then you occasionally bring into the story key people in the trade, key Mexican police officials, to to humanize and also to provide some granular detail as to what's going on. I was wondering if there is one or two individuals that in particular that you talk about in your book that you feel that you want to highlight to give you examples of these broader trends that you've described over the course of your book.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in terms of the writing and the way that it's formatted, you rightly say this is not an orthodox, in some ways it's not an orthodox history book or an orthodox, certainly academic history book. I've designed it, I mean, before I wrote it, I read a lot of Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, James Ellroy. I mean, I've tried to write it almost like, if I could, like a kind of noir novel. And that's very much what I was kind of inspired by. So I not only introduced characters, I tended to also kind of write action set pieces. I've attempted to kind of keep sentences short, to remove a lot of the kind of academic verbiage and keep a kind of staccato rhythm to the entire piece. So that was quite deliberate on my part. And basically because I feel that this is too important a subject to leave to simply academics. And my hope is that over the the next few years, a fair amount of the kind of general public will also read this book and kind of reconsider their relationship to Mexico, their relationship to narcotics, etc. I suppose in terms of the kind of characters, that's a very good question. One of them that really struck me, and it was a bit of a kind of archival find, which led me on down this path, was a guy called Raul Mendiolea. Now, Raul Mendiolea was head of the judicial police in the 1970s, and he really orchestrates this takeover of local protection rackets. He basically runs the drug trade, despite being head of the federal police. But I thought what was fascinating is I find him running around his hometown of Ciudad Juarez in the 1930s, still as a policeman, but working basically as a hitman, taking out rival drug dealers. So I thought it was kind of fascinating that his career, 40 years in the making, had always been kind of been officially in the police, but it had always been kind of connected to narcotics as well. In terms of another character that I really enjoyed researching and writing about, it is this character that a few other people have mentioned. Her name is Ignacia Hasso, La Nacha, who was basically in charge of the Ciudad Juarez drug industry from the late 20s through to the 1960s. For a start, we assume the vast majority of drug traffickers and drug peddlers are men. But I think this assumption is kind of baked into a lot of the mythology. Why are drug traffickers men? Because drug traffickers are violent. Who are more violent? Men. But in actual fact, certainly up to the 1930s, a lot of the drug peddlers and drug chemists and drug smugglers were actually women, because all it was an extension of orthodox commerce. So it was fascinating learning about this woman, La Nacha, her kind of remarkable commercial mind. And we managed to get hold of somewhere in the region of 20 or 30 drug cases in the archives of Ciudad Juarez, which explained in granular detail how she ran her operation. She was very smart. She rarely kind of touched the drugs herself, but in certain low points, she would even sell it out of the back of her house because she was protected at that point by the police. But in the main, she used a network of women, a lot of them prostitutes, in order to sell it to people going around the red light district of Ciudad Juarez. She was a formidable figure. Another thing that fascinated me about her is that whenever she got caught, she would claim to have some kind of religious awakening, which played very well. It played really well on the U.S. side of the border, right? She can be saved. So these like pastors would turn up in Ciudad Juarez and try and meet her and try and save her soul. It was a kind of really clever bit of PR. I mean, I'm not saying it was entirely, but it was very convenient. She only converted when she was stuck in jail.
There's something about it that when I was reading it, that just struck me as how it was so. It like so much of the drug trade, it was so specifically targeted to Americans. You know, the evangelical notion of you know, conversion and rebirth and being able to walk away from one's sin through it, and that strikes me as something that is so appealing to so many Americans.
Yeah, No, I think that you're absolutely right. So even cynical ways to escape jail were focused on the Americans rather on the Mexicans. So no, you're absolutely right. That was kind of fascinating.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Right, that's a good question. As you might guess from the early bits of this podcast, I've been working quite a lot actually on writing up fairly dry political theory on working out how the drug trade and the transnational drug trade affects state formation, not only in Mexico, but in a full loads of other countries, Afghanistan, Colombia. So trying to do something more comparative. In terms of my route back to popular history, I have two ideas. The first one is to write the history of Trotsky's death. He was shot in Mexico. He was shot at, and then he got an ice pick in his head in Mexico. And Mexico's foremost detective, an extraordinary man called Cuidoz Cuarón, the uncle, apparently, of the director, Alfonso Cuarón, he basically investigated the murder and used some of the first fingerprint technology to actually track down who did it. So I was wondering if to kind of write a kind of murder mystery about him. The other person I was thinking of doing maybe a kind of biography of is another fairly extraordinary person called Oscar Zeta Acocha. I don't know if you've heard of him, who's a major Chicano civil rights lawyer during the 1960s until his death in 1974, it appears, at the hands of drug dealers down in Mazatlan in Sinaloa. The other interesting thing about Zeta Acosta is he is the model. He is the model for Hunter S. Thompson's 300-pound Samoan lawyer. That is actually Oscar Zeta Acocha, a Chicano rights lawyer. So I thought it might be kind of interesting to look at this extraordinary period where civil rights meets narcotics, meets Hunter S. Thompson. So I thought that might be a kind of interesting period to look at through the eyes of this extraordinary civil rights lawyer.
Well, those sound like fascinating books, and I hope that when you're done with them, we can have you back on the podcast to discuss them.
No, certainly. Thank you very much. Absolutely, Mark. I'll be delighted.
Well, Ben Smith, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.